Hello, welcome to the House of Commons podcast. This is a weekly podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem blogger and now I'm just an independent blogger. This is the 98th episode, so we're actually coming up to our 100th episode where we're going to have a couple of special guests on. I'll probably tell you more about that at the end. But joining me for this episode, I'm delighted to say, are Kelly Marie Blundell, who is Lib Dem PPC for Guildford. And also she's a council member of the Social Liberal Forum within the Lib Dems and also a Federal Policy Committee member. Good evening, Kelly Marie.
Good evening.
Hello, great to have you. And also joining us is Paul Blanchard, who is a former Labour councillor and parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party. Good evening, Paul.
Hi, Mark.
Hello. Well, it's great to have you both. And it's been a busy week on the political front. So the first thing that I want to cover and kind of have to cover is the floods. Now, my colleague Emma, when she hosted last week, covered this, but it is pretty much the only political game in town in terms of England politics in the last week or so. It's certainly been leading all the stories. So, Kelly Marie, do you want to start us off on your perception of how things have gone, whether the government's reacted well, and how you think generally from the political side of things are looking?
Yes, quite happy to, Mark. One thing I will say, I had some friends over today who were from Australia, and they said that people in Australia had been phoning them to ask them if they were okay. News of the floods in Britain is so widespread that the rest of the world seems to think we're entirely underwater. How has it gone? Well, to be honest, it's gone really quite badly, hasn't it? And there are a significant amount of politicians that are standing in the water, displacing the water further and looking at people. And actually, how many people are actually out there doing things and helping people? That's got to be the question. In Guildford, we haven't had anywhere near as bad as Somerset, but we've certainly had half a foot of water and the river's breaking its banks and going into people's houses, and that's been absolutely devastating for a lot of people. On Christmas Eve, we had councillors down there helping people get out of their homes. What are we going to do about it? Well, there's a short-term fix, there's an immediate fix, and there's a long-term fix. And the problem is that everybody's talking about short-term fixes, but I'm really concerned also about those long-term fixes, because it's all very well saying, oh, well, the water will go away, but what's going to happen is people's insurance is going to go up, and they're going to bear the long-term brunt and cost of the flooding in their insurance premiums because of failures to put in correct defences and because of failures for people to notify the right people or be aware of the problems that are going to happen. So it would be good to see both addressed.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think though that we talk about like the defences that could have been put in place, but and these are very, very unusual circumstances in terms of the weather. I mean, we've had this is like the worst we've seen for something like 250 years. So, I mean, is it reasonable to expect the government and councils to put measures in place to try and mitigate things that supposedly, fingers crossed anyway, because who knows with climate change, but, you know, certainly historically have happened so infrequently?
But Mark, that's the point that you make, really, because they're becoming progressively less and less unusual. These are, you know, the consequences, the long-term consequences of climate change, and the government has failed to do anything on that at all, both in the long term and in the short term. And what I find like fascinating politically is that the government don't seem to be getting any flack for this in terms of, you know, their cuts to the Environment Agency. No wonder Chris Smith, you know, doesn't have the resources to deal with this. And the media seem to be buying the line that, oh, yes, Chris Smith is incompetent, that he's not doing a good job. But of course, he's doing the best with the very diminished resources he has. And for me, I'm reminded of all of those images of David Cameron, you know, going with the husky and all this kind of stuff, the so-called environmentalist green agenda leader of the opposition. And where has that gone? He seems to be saying, oh, yes, there's a blank check. And then his own secretaries of state and ministers are immediately clarifying what the prime minister says after he said it four times in P&Q, PMQ, saying that actually money no object doesn't mean a blank check. But that's clearly what he meant. Sorry, Kelly Marie, I interrupted there, but I had to get that off my chest.
That's okay. And I don't think that climate change is just the only thing, though, Paul. I think there are other things that could have been done that weren't done. And while this is the worst flooding in 250 years, you can't say that we haven't had flooding in 250 years. And I don't necessarily think in some areas that adequate provisions were in for normal levels of flooding, let alone what we're seeing now. For example, there were no the warnings put on the relative bits of the River Wey where I am, when they said that there was no risk of flooding along the 25 houses that were flooded in Guildford on Christmas Eve, let alone now. And so the checks and balances aren't in place for average flooding, let alone down in Somerset.
On the whole money is no object thing, I mean, you're right, Cameron said that several times, and he repeated it at PMQs, and I thought that Ed Miliband was onto something when he started to, you know, try and chip away at that. I mean, is there not a risk, I mean, Paul, maybe you can give us your view on this, is there not a risk that Cameron has now left himself wide open to that quote being thrown back at him every single time the government now talks about cuts? Because he's already said, I understand that he meant it in a fairly limited context of the emergency response to the specific problems of the flooding. But now that the words have left his mouth, aren't they going to be forever used to kind of, you know, nail him to the wall with?
Yes, and not unreasonably, because he's not some, you know, local councillor that misspeaks in some kind of subcommittee meeting on potholes in the road. This man is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. He said it. He said that phrase four times in Prime Minister's questions. He has the might of the number 10 machine behind him. He ought not to be making schoolboy errors like that. And if he says something that clearly people can draw a mistaken conclusion from, then he has to take responsibility for that, surely. He said that money was no object. There was no kind of, I'm reminded of those kind of mobile phone offers where it says, you know, you get a free mobile phone and there's a little asterisk above it where it says free, and you have to kind of go to the bottom of the advert to say that this is not free at all. This is exactly what David Cameron has done here. He can't use phrases like that to try and wriggle out of the fact that him, you know, him and his coalition have chronically underinvested in the Environment Agency, swinging cuts to the department. No wonder they don't have the resources to do a proper job. And then for him to try and make, you know, turn it around by using misleading phrases and blaming, you know, the guy at the top who is just happens to be a Labour politician, they put him in place. So it just seems awfully convenient for them. And for me, I'm just wondering why the media hasn't cottoned on to this.
I do want to say, though, I mean, you've mentioned the cuts a couple of times, Paul, and I have to say I haven't seen the organisational chart cuts at DEFRA or at the elsewhere. But I do wonder whether those cuts are directly relevant to the flooding. And it's very difficult. It's very easy to bandy around and say, oh, we've made cuts here, we've made cuts there, and now everyone's being flooded. But actually, those cuts could have been managerial posts that weren't needed, or they could be cuts that involved condensing post room services. So I don't think you can necessarily say the cuts have impacted on our ability to protect the flooding.
Well, Kelly Marie, I just want to say that, I mean, the Lib Dems, they're kind of seen as the most green party, or at least, you know, historically they've been seen as such. There's probably some in Labour who'd quibble with that, but, you know, certainly I think a lot of Lib Dem members would consider themselves to be like that. And, you know, I know some people who, you know, are involved in Lib Dem politics primarily because of the fact that they are seen as so green. So do you think that the Lib Dems in government have done enough? Because it kind of strikes me that the fact that there have been cuts here and there, and that the Environment Agency appears to not have been able to do everything that it wanted to do, and also that if we can believe what Chris Smith was saying, there were very stringent criteria put on how they could spend their money. So they wanted to do some dredging in the Somerset Levels, for example, but they were only able to put £400,000 forward, and that wasn't enough. And then there wasn't any match funding. So when you start hearing things like that, it starts to feel like the whole Hugger Husky thing was really just greenwashing, that the Lib Dems haven't really been able to push back against what I presume has been a pretty strong rearguard action from people like George Osborne, who we all know isn't really signed up to the green agenda.
I like to think that the Lib Dems are green, and that we've done an awful lot with investment in a variety of green areas within the government. However, we can't win every battle, can we? Sorry to sound just like a politician, but...
you are a politician, Kelly.
I know. But certainly, I mean, the coalition is about compromise, and we can't get everything through that we want to. And this is a really, you could say, well, if the flooding is down to the failure to invest money wisely within the environmental departments and do the dredging and that is down to the Conservatives getting their way in this particular debate, then we lost out on that debate, but that's having really quite significant consequences.
So do you think that that's likely to change now? I mean, there's obviously now a very strong political imperative to do something about the floods, but do you think that will translate into strengthening the Lib Dems' hands within government to be able to do more on the green agenda?
Yes and no. And I think the problem is that you're talking about what is quite a macro idea with quite a specific problem. We're talking about flooding that is occurring during the winter months. And it's very difficult to take that and say, OK, so we've now got to take all the money and invest it in climate change resources. Or as the news said, now the jet stream might have changed. And it's very difficult to apply a macro idea across everything on the green agenda. I think that we're doing significant amount for the green agenda as it is. We're nowhere near as much as I would like to see, but there are huge steps forward. But how that actually applies to flooding long term and the Lib Dems' ability to prevent it is difficult to predict either way.
Paul, what do you think about Ed Miliband's response to this whole thing? Because there's not really a lot leaders of the opposition can do, but he cancelled a trip abroad and he's been going down to the flooded areas. Do you think he's done enough? And do you think there's much he can do?
Well, it's very difficult, really, isn't it? I mean, as you correctly pointed out, he's the leader of the opposition and there's very little he can do. But he was Secretary of State for the Environment, don't forget, you know, in the previous cabinet. So he does have some expertise on this. I don't know. I mean, if I was advising Ed, I wouldn't have had those kind of pictures of him like all the other politicians, you know, with the newly bought wellies in all the floods. There was a thing on BuzzFeed, wasn't there, about 28 pictures of them. And, you know, you can, I think everyone, you know, couldn't help but chuckle at them. So, I personally think he had to cancel the trip abroad, but I also think, you know, he then didn't take advantage of that, really, because he doesn't seem to have really done anything beyond that, really. And I agree with what you're just saying. It's very, very difficult for leader of the opposition. I think if I was advising him, he needs to focus on the fact that, you know, that the Environment Agency hasn't had the resources to deal with this, because where else could he go from a political strategy point of view? You know, he was the outgoing Environment Secretary in the previous government, so that, you know, he's also, you know, there's a coalition now, so there's both parties he can have a go at. I don't see that fight's been there, frankly. But very disappointing from my point of view.
And it strikes me that Ed Miliband has learned the lesson of David Cameron. I think it was in 2007 when the floods in his constituency, and he went off on some trip to Rwanda, and he was very heavily criticised for not being around and in his constituency when this was happening. And I think if anything, Ed Miliband's probably overlearned that lesson and felt like he had to get stuck in. But when he got down there, kind of realised can't actually do anything.
That's where you and I would disagree, Mark. I think he has to promise something to have some credibility. You know, the pictures on BuzzFeed of him in wellies isn't enough. People are looking for substance here. We have a general election next year, and I think him and his policy team should have got together. And where they could have stolen a real march on the government is done like a little pledge card and said, look, here's five promises that we are going to make that are going to differentiate us from the coalition, that if we get in next year, this is exactly what we're going to do differently. But we just seem to be paralyzed by kind of media micromanagement at the moment. You know, which politician's marginally ahead of the other one? There's no real strategic leadership here. And I actually agree with Kelly Marie. You know, I think that the Lib Dems largely are doing quite a good job in the coalition. You know, there's some cheap kind of attacks to be made on the Lib Dems, but I think the reality of the situation is they are a junior coalition partner. They've got some of their way and they're to be respected for that. But on this one, they've not won. And frankly, as you can see, the government is getting it wrong. But where I think the Miliband camp are missing a trick is that we haven't provided a viable alternative. If you speak to someone, you know, any members of your family, and say, has the government done a good job on this? They'd probably say, well, you know, they're doing their best to try and make the best of a bad situation. The economy's knackered, so they're having to make cuts caused by Gordon Brown. And, you know, where's Ed Miliband's alternative? What's he actually saying that's materially different? And that, to me, is where he's failed.
Just before we move on from this whole subject, I just wanted to talk about something. It's a little bit tangential to it, but seems to, well, put it this way, I was in newsagent about 3 days ago and I saw the front cover of the Daily Mail, and it absolutely disgusted me personally, because they appear to have started some kind of campaign to get foreign aid stopped so that we can take that money that is apparently being given to people who don't deserve it and then spent on the floods here. And actually, it is related to what we're talking about the whole money is no object thing, because I think Cameron used that phrase in order to try and head that campaign off at the pass by pointing out that actually there is money available. But I mean, it sounds like from both of your reactions, we're going to get an outbreak of agreement here. But I mean, is there any justification for that? I mean, you know, I've heard the argument said that, you know, we're helping to fund the India space program. And I think there's some funding in Pakistan that's being used for some kind of technology thing. I mean, is there any justification for this? Or is it just the Daily Mail being disgusting and you keep jumping on that bandwagon?
I just come in there. I think that the problem with the Daily Mail is they lead on headlines and stories without substance, don't they? And this is a headline response to a headline problem without actually either analysing the detail or the detail of the result. I don't think that you can give out aid and then dictate to countries what they use it on. And I don't think that that area of the of the budget is necessarily to be hijacked to be used. I'm sure that there is money that can be found to help with the floods, and there are other areas that can be attacked. But to say that we will cease all foreign aid really just sounds like something Nigel Farage would come out with, doesn't it?
Well, he did.
I think
that's what the Daily Mail would piggybacking on. Paul, what do you think?
Well, I have to admit some hypocrisy at the moment. I think that the Daily Mail is the most disgusting newspaper there is. And I hate myself because I read it cover to cover every day. You know, and that is the problem. I mean, I've given up alcohol. I've given up caffeine. The next big thing I'm going to give up in terms of my addictions is the Daily Mail, because it is a horrible, pernicious paper. And I hate the fact that I read it. And I think you're entirely right, Kelly Marie, because they have got it wrong. But it's not just a question of kind of what to me strikes me as particularly horrible about this is linking, you know, the DFID budget to floods, because they're two separate pots of money. One of the things I'm actually proud of this government for doing is ring fencing the money for DFID. It's often usually foreign aid is one of the things that's the first to be cut. And I think that is making a real difference, you know, saving lives around the world. And it's something that this government should be proud of. I disagree with Kelly Marie in terms of, you know, you can't give them money and tell them how to spend it. I think that's exactly what DFID should be doing. You know, if we're going to give X million to whatever country, then it should be for something, you know, focused, ring fence, particular project that's going to help save or improve the lives of their citizens. So I don't see that as a problem. But to me, there's a wider issue here in terms of the evil of the Daily Mail. Why didn't they link this to say, well, forget the DFID budget. Why is the government letting Vodafone off £30 billion in taxes and doing dodgy deals? You know, there's a massive source of money that the Inland Revenue could have got. And we're letting big corporations off literally dozens of billions of pounds. You know, when DFID's budget represents, you know, it's such a minuscule amount overall, why doesn't the Daily Mail target its ire there and say, look, let's get the money that we're owed from Vodafone and let's put £30 billion into flood prevention rather than, you know, pandering to, frankly, the racist agenda of their readers? It's disgusting. And I'm not only disgusted at them, but I'm disgusted at myself for reading the damn thing.
Yeah, I'm disgusted at you as well, Paul. I hate the Daily Mail, you know, in the same way as you just described, and I don't generally read it. I mean, occasionally I will, you know, see a link to something and I'll kind of click on it and read it. But I mean, you know, it's the Daily Mail have on occasion done good things. So I think back to the people who were accused of murdering Stephen Lawrence, and they put their pictures on the front cover and with the headline "Murderers" and dared them to sue them for libel. You know, that was the Daily Mail.
Stephen Lawrence's father just happened to be the painter and decorator at Paul Dacre's house.
So you know, maybe there were reasons specifically why, but you know, that's an example of the good that they can do. And in this situation, I don't understand why they didn't do a big push for fundraising to help the flood victims. You know, that is the sort of thing that I would have been 100% behind and would have made me think, oh, look, the Daily Mail are doing some good. Instead, it's just nasty, xenophobic, just the usual crap that they come out
with. You know what the biggest charge is, though, Mark? Because you're entirely right. The biggest problem they've got is they're lazy. What you just advocated there would have been brilliant, but would have taken effort and also would have been slightly humiliating if they'd have only got £1 million or £2, you know, when Comic Relief can raise so much money. And it's just lazy journalism to just say, well, let's, you know, all this money that we're sending to foreigners, let's just cut that. So, you know, let's help ourselves first. It's ridiculous.
I think there's, sorry, Mark, I just want to do one question. You said that's one good thing that the Daily Mail could do? I'm going to put you on the spot here. What's the second good thing the Daily Mail has done?
Oh, good question.
I don't. Maybe we should ask the Vice President of the Media Society.
This is unfair. This isn't some kind of circular good question. Well, to be honest, as Vice President of the Media Society, I think that we need to know from the people that matter. Do we have anyone on this podcast that's actually standing for Parliament at the next election who might be able to answer the question? It's the legislators that matter. The
shoulders are incredibly slopey today, aren't they? I mean, Kelly Marie, what I would say is that there are, you know, some of the investigations that they've done over the years, some of the pieces that they have, kind of real life stories of, you know, horrendous things that people have been through, and, you know, highlighting things like that. You know, there are good things. Let's face it, there's a little bit of good in the worst of us and a little bit of bad in the best of us. You know, it's like that, isn't it? But overall, I think the Daily Mail, I mean, you've only got to look at some of the things they've done. I mean, this horrendous thing that they did a few years ago, which was in Britain, they campaigned against the HPV vaccine. And in Ireland, the Daily Mail in Ireland campaigned for it. And it was purely just because they felt that the prejudices of their readers were being pandered to in each territory. And it was all about the sales. It's nothing to do with the health of young girls getting that vaccine. I mean, just things like that. It's absolutely disgusting.
Actually, looping this back around to the petition, the value of data is so high now, as Edward Snowden mentioned a couple of weeks ago, by running a petition, not only are the Daily Mail driving people to their website, they're driving people to their website that wouldn't give to an appeal for money, but they're also getting those people's details. They're getting their IP addresses, they're getting their name and address when they sign up, and that data is worth an absolute fortune to a newspaper like the Daily Mail, because they can then sell that data to advertisers. So actually, not only is it cowardly journalism, but they're going to get financial gain from it as well.
Absolutely. Very good point. And actually, on the subject of petitions, another thing we wanted to talk about tonight is that a petition which was started by Karen Lucas, our one and only Green MP in Parliament, which was asking for an impact assessment to be performed on the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971. And I actually, to my shame, because this is something I have campaigned on over the years, but I wasn't aware of this particular petition. And someone pointed it out to me on, I don't know what night it was, a few nights ago anyway, and I saw it, and it had like 84,000 signatures at that point. It needs over 100,000 before that threshold gets triggered for it then to be seriously considered for a debate in Parliament. And I was very, I mean, I tweeted about it, and I was very pleased to see within a few hours, it was like there were a few more thousand signatures, and it was pretty clear it was going to reach the target. And actually, it got 129,000 in the space of, well, it must have got maybe 40,000 odd in the space of only 3 or 4 days, which was really good to see. I wanted to talk about this, firstly, in and of the substance itself. I mean, the idea of an impact assessment on the Misuse of Drugs Act to see whether we're getting value for money, whether it's working, whether it's reducing harm, or whether other approaches might be appropriate. Paul, do you think that this is likely to happen? I know that drugs policy is also something that's close to your political heart as well. Do you think this is likely to make any difference? Do you think they'll have the debate?
I don't think they will, really. I really don't know what's going to happen, really, in terms of drugs policy. I mean, I just to start from the very beginning, it's clear that we've lost the war on drugs. Russell Brand talks a lot of what word am I allowed to say, Mark? I forget on this podcast.
Nonsense, crap.
In terms of revolution and everything, but he does speak a lot of sense in terms of, you know, society does look at drugs in the wrong way. We look at it as a criminal justice matter, and we need to look at it as a medical matter. I personally would legalize all drugs. I think it would put the drug dealers out of business, but would mean that the state could actually get involved in regulating the market and helping people, because the reality of the situation is, if I wanted to get some heroin or some cocaine or whatever, you know, I'm sure, you know, within 2 or 3 phone calls, I'd be able to get some. So the state, you know, the state has acknowledged that it's failed to regulate the supply of drugs, and therefore
we're in danger of agreeing there.
agree that this is the problem with a lot of policies like this, though, unfortunately, is that no party seems to have the balls to actually to take this on and actually, you know, make the policy pronouncements that really, really would make a change in society. And that's one of the reasons I'm so disillusioned with the kind of Westminster bubble at the moment, is we seem to be arguing our way in a paper bag over minutiae when there's massive issues in society that we seem to be ignoring, one of which is drugs policy. What's your view, Kelly Marie?
I supported the Liberal Democrats put forward a motion to conference in September 2010, and I felt actually the motion was a bit weak and didn't go far enough in decriminalising drug use in society and providing help and support for people with drug and alcohol addictions. However, it was pretty radical for a party of government to put forward a policy at that time and was dealt with as such. I'm looking at the petition now, and it's 129,000 at the moment, and I imagine it will continue to go up and up.
Well, I think it's closed actually, so I think that's
I wanted to add my name to it.
The one thing I will say about it is what it is calling for is for an impact assessment. Well, I'm sorry, but what's an impact assessment going to do?
Exactly.
What action is going to come out of it? What it's calling for is bureaucracy around drugs policy.
If they want an impact assessment, all they have to do is just walk out of Whitehall, turn left and just walk up Charing Cross, really, and just look at
people.
Well,
I didn't even need to go that far.
Exactly.
it's an area that interests me a great deal. I went to a lecture by Paddy Ashton recently where he was talking about the war in Afghanistan and how the war in Afghanistan, which people always seem to be afraid to say, is actually about controlling the opium trade.
Yes.
And unfortunately, the problem that we face, I think, strategically, in an ideal world, we would decriminalise or legalise drug use, then we would not only be able to tax and gain revenue from drug use, but we would be able to help people that had addictions without treating them as a criminal justice issue.
Absolutely.
But all the time, we don't control that supply, that origin of the drug, we will be funding the criminal networks that it underpins.
Absolutely.
And the same applies to the cocaine trade in America as well. And this is where the issue is. So unless we start manufacturing heroin, manufacturing cocaine, it's very difficult to decriminalise or legalise that trade.
I've not drank for 3 or 4 years now, and I'm involved a little bit with alcohol concern, and I even am trying to get involved in regulating the sugar industry. I've started to get involved in Action on Sugar. In fact, I have a podcast, Mark, which I'll blatantly plug now, which is sugarpodcast.org.uk. But the advantage of alcohol, tobacco and sugar, all of these things that can cause addictions, is they're already legal, and the entrepreneurs and the businesses that are, and the conglomerates that control the supply of those substances have to obey the law, and therefore we can regulate them. So it just seems ridiculous as a society that there are the variety of addictive substances, some of which we can control, and you know, because they're cooperative, and you know, they might kick up a stink and decide that they don't want to do X, Y, and Z, but at the end of the day, when Parliament legislates, they have to comply. And yet the most dangerous of the drugs, cocaine, ecstasy, heroin, all of these kinds of things, we leave them to, you know, entirely to the supply of drug dealers, horrible people that have, you know, no conscience or anything whatsoever. And that, to me, just seems, as a society, that we've got a duality that, we to kind of leave them to. It just seems insane.
Well, Kelly Marie, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about Lib Dem policy and kind of how it relates to government policy, because I left the Lib Dems a few months ago, as you know, and I did a fairly long, rambling, self-indulgent blog post about why I left. And one of the reasons was that one of the main issues that I've campaigned on over the years has been drugs policy. And one of the reasons I joined the Lib Dems is because there seemed to be a lot of, you know, like-minded people within the party, and some of them within the senior echelons of the party. And the Lib Dem policy, as you point out, has been pretty good. I mean, Ewan Hoyle, became a pretty good friend of mine. He's the head of the Lib Dems.
I know Ewan well.
Lib Dems for drug policy reform. And there's other people involved in that, like Adam Corlett and Pratik Booch, I know, has been involved, in Duncan Stott. You know, some of these people have done some fantastic stuff. And the policy that got passed at the conference you were talking about, I thought, certainly of all the main parties, is by far and away the best policy. And, you know, kind of, I know that before that policy got put through conference, kind of back channel contact was made between LDDPR and Nick Clegg, and they said, you know, we're going to do this, just so you know. And the feedback they got was, go for it. And I think subsequently, the sort of comments that Clegg has made, I mean, I interviewed Clegg at Lib Dem conference in 2012 after I won something. The prize was 25 minutes with Nick Clegg. Second prize was 50 minutes with Nick Clegg. That's a joke, that second bit. So I got to interview him for 25 minutes.
Sorry, that's the first time I've heard that joke, actually. That's quite good.
It's a pretty old joke.
That's really good.
In all kinds of other contexts. But no, and he was a really nice guy. I interviewed him and I asked him about drugs policy. I was very surprised at his response, actually, because I was expecting him to bat it away, like he had done with my question about republicanism. But when it came to drugs policy, he said, and he was quite open about it, he said, I think that, you know, we have these inquiries and we see the evidence and then we ignore the evidence. He said, I think we need to start listening to the evidence. He said that there's a Home Office Select Committee report coming out in December. So this was December 2012, it was due out. He said, and when that comes out, we should look very carefully at what they say and act upon it. And then he kept his word. In December, he did talk about it. He was very open about his views on it. And since then, he's made more public statements. But what really frustrates me is that when you actually look at what the government has done, it's, for example, made 200 legal highs illegal since it's been in office. And they seem to be very proud of that. They keep talking about it. They keep pushing it. Norman Baker is now piloting legislation, not even legislation, actually. I think it just happens behind the scenes. So he is pushing for ketamine to be changed from Class C to Class B. It seems like the government is going in the opposite direction of travel to what the Lib Dems want, even though we have the drugs minister. And how does that make you feel as a Lib Dem?
Well, just before Kelly Marie answers that, can I just say, as a Labour Party member, I was outraged when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister that we reclassified cannabis the other way. You know, we'd actually made some inroads into having a sensible policy in recategorising it to Class C based on evidence, based on David Nutt and other scientists, you know, a real understanding of the harm or lack of harm that cannabis does. I mean, I personally don't take cannabis, but I think that was the right move. And for Gordon Brown, against all scientific evidence and on a whim, almost on a personal whim, if reports are to be believed, to recategorise it back to Class B was absolutely disgusting. So I don't think the Labour Party, you know, has covered itself in glory on drugs policy, and indeed, actually, you know, has acted quite shamefully.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kelly Marie.
I agree with that, Paul. And, you know, and Labour Party, for me personally, has a pretty shameful history on drugs. But the reason why I'm so disappointed with the Lib Dems is because I really hoped for better now that they're in government.
Hopefully we would actually do it. I think the first thing to point out, and we've already pointed out once in the podcast, is that the Lib Dems are a junior partner in the coalition. Certainly after we passed the policy, there were various interviews with people like Tom Brake, looking at opportunities where we could examine reforming drug policy, and in particular a study in Portugal where they piloted decriminalizing class C drugs, which was very successful. And there was an EDM, an early day motion, put down which was looked to start a ball rolling. I think the problem is it's not in the coalition agreements to decriminalize drugs, and it's very easy again to say we'll decriminalize drugs, but actually that's a huge step, and it's rather like independence of Scotland. It's so complicated it makes your head ache.
No, Kelly Marie, I mean I've been campaigning on this, and I've studied this enough to know how difficult it is, but the frustration I have is that they've gone the other way. So the legal highs that have been made illegal, the CAT, which is a drug that's used, it's a fairly mild stimulant that's used in Somali communities and Yemeni communities and Ethiopian communities. There is no real evidence that needs to be made illegal, but this government has made it illegal.
Mark.
And it's like, you know, that's what frustrates me. So, you know, even if all they'd have been able to do is just apply a brake and say, we're not making any more things illegal and we're not changing the classification of anything, we can't get any progress, but we'll dig our heels in and we won't let them do anything.
I appreciate that, Mark. I mean, I'm not going to answer on behalf of Norman Baker. And certainly when he was appointed Home Office Minister, there was a lot of discussion about whether we could actually take drug policy further within the coalition and start to see some decriminalisation. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen, certainly not if the Queen's speech reports or anything to go by. However, there's a lot of debate. I mean, for example, the rating of ketamine. Ketamine is an extremely dangerous drug. And if you take it in isolation, it probably should be Class B as opposed to Class C because of the damage it wreaks on the body. However, the problem that is there is it's almost two separate issues. We class drugs by a certain barriers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that if we decriminalise them all, those classes would mean whether it was worse to be caught with one or not. if that makes sense. It's a very, very messy, very complicated subject, and it's not as easy as saying, let's just decriminalise one drug or all drugs, because the work and the effort that would go into making that work in society, not putting people in danger and making sure support systems are in place, not just for retail and revenue, but also for people with addictions, is a huge task for any government to undertake. I think what I would like to see is a cross-party committee on changing drug laws in the country, addressing drug laws, addressing addiction issues and criminal justice issues around those, and have a working consensus moving forward over the next 15 to 20 years to actually put changes in place.
I would love to see that. Unfortunately, I just can't see it happening, partly because it's just too easy a political hit for someone, you know, if someone stands up and says, look, we should do something about this, for other politicians and the media, the tabloid press, to just shoot them down and accuse them of being soft on drugs. And any time an election is in the offing, all the heads go below the parapet. And there is often an election on. I mean, that's why I think Nick Clegg has been pretty brave to do what he's done. But unfortunately, it just hasn't actually led to any action. But on a more positive note, I think that the tide of history is running against the prohibitionists. We're seeing this internationally.
It doesn't
now
work. You only have to watch an episode of Boardwalk Empire to know that prohibition doesn't work.
Yeah, or The Wire.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that this is where, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but this is where genuine courage needs to be had on account of the leadership of our political parties. I think that this would be a big vote winner. If Ed Miliband said in the election, you know, I appreciate this is going to take 15 to 20 years, that, you know, that's incredibly complex. I know that I'm going to be accused tomorrow by being soft on drugs by the Daily Mail, but that's why, rather than, running away from this issue, I'm going to put my head above the parapet and say that in principle, that we should look toward legalising as many drugs as possible and treating this as a medical problem rather than as a criminal justice issue, because the reality is at the moment the state has no role in regulating the supply of drugs other than, you know, occasionally putting the odd drug dealer away. But we're paying for it anyway. You know, when houses are burgled, it's let's be honest, if you got burgled tonight, Mark, could be pretty certain that whoever burgled your house would be a heroin addict. And therefore we're paying for heroin now through the state, through increased home insurance premiums. So this unfortunately is why people are disillusioned with politics, because the big issues in society now, as far as I'm concerned, are the ones that mainstream politicians don't actually, you know, make any pronouncements upon, because they know they're going to get slated in the short term by the media. But that's what I think people are looking for, is genuine leadership on these issues. So I'm with Kelly Marie. Of course it might take 15 to 20 years, but it's still a journey of 1,000 miles starts with that first step. And that first step will be Nick Clegg or Ed Miliband, someone in a position of genuine authority to say, we have lost the war on drugs and it's time to rethink it. Let's, as a society, take the first step to say what we need to do and do it in reality rather than just saying it.
Yeah, and Paul, I agree. Paul, I mean, I agree with you. And I, like I said, I think the tide of history is good. I think in 20 or 30 years, we will have decriminalisation, possibly even legalisation of most of these substances. But I don't think it will come from within our politics. I think it will come internationally and we'll get dragged along with it eventually.
But to be honest, I think that makes sense because it is a global industry. I think it's one thing to say this makes logical sense, and I think to a lot of people it does make logical sense. There are issues around, obviously, the more small C and capital C conservative mindset. The case that comes to mind is Leah Betts. And going back to the Daily Mail, I remember those headlines.
I remember Leah Betts.
And that's the sort of case that will be trawled out, obviously, and said why this is a bad thing, and that apparently everyone's going to start dropping like flies from drug use.
You see, the thing is, Leah Betts died of, I think it's called hypoxia, which is an overdose of water, because she drank too much water, because she thought that she needed to overcompensate for the fact that when you take ecstasy, you can become dehydrated. And
it's
the problem is
water intoxication.
There we go.
Yes, I agree with you. And that's because the state didn't say, you know, if you go to a pharmacist and ask for a drug, the pharmacist says, even if you get ibuprofen now, they say, are you realise that this could be hard on your stomach and you should take it with a meal? You know, that's the state's job, is to regulate and advise people, but not to say, whoever sold her that ecstasy tablet just wanted to get the sale. Now, I'm sure there's a company that will want to sell her that ecstasy tablet, but they can be then regulated by the state to say, hand a leaflet out, don't drink too much water, make sure you do that, because the reality is we've lost the war on drugs. She will be able to get that ecstasy tablet, whoever supplies it, so we might as well adopt a harm reduction strategy and supply it to her, but in a responsible way.
Just before we wrap up on this, I just wanted to pick up on something you said there, Paul, because, I mean, I agree. I mean, this has obviously been we've pretty much all agreed on this. But when you said about Ed Miliband, you know, on the first leaders debate before the election, he should make that statement. The thing is, they put Neil Kinnock's head in a light bulb, didn't they? They would put Ed Miliband's head on the end of a spliff on the front page of The Sun. You know what it's like, and that is why he won't do it, even if... And I suspect he probably does largely agree with what we said here, but he won't do that because, you know, there are bigger battles to fight, aren't there?
But there are ways and means. So, for example, when we gave independence to the Bank of England, you know, was that in our 1997 manifesto? No, it wasn't. The day after we won, it was announced in the media and no one actually said, you know, how dare you do something as big as this, Gordon, without even having the, you know, the courtesy to tell the electorate. People said, well, it'll probably work. And it turned out that actually taking the politics out of setting, the party politics out of setting the interest rate was actually something more important than short-term party political gain. He could become Prime Minister and then the day after, in exactly the same way Gordon did about giving independence to the Bank of England, say, look, I'm very, you know, it's obvious that we've lost the war on drugs. Just saying that would be a good step in the right direction in terms of giving us and then saying, well, let's have some kind of royal commission and let it report a year later, because that then gives society a year to have a sensible debate about this and contribute to a royal commission. I mean, you know, I think that to me is quite a sensible way of trying to make this issue not about party politics, because for me, the biggest issues in society now for me aren't actually about party politics. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not, you know, as I mean, I wouldn't advocate leaving a political party like you did, Mark. And I think that's party politics is loss. But on the other hand, some of the issues that facing society now need a genuine, you know, consensus that goes beyond party politics. And this is one of them.
That's a very good example. Just to bring it full circle there, Mark, I mean, yeah, let's bring it round and let's have a proper debate. Let's have a cross-party debate on it. And actually, that's where this petition that's being put forward falls down so significantly, because it's not saying let's have a debate, let's look at decriminalisation of drugs. What it's saying is let's look at some paperwork on drugs. Doesn't say what we're going to do with that paperwork. And it almost to me sounds like something that we would hear from coalition ministers kicking things into the long grass. Let's do an impact assessment.
To be fair, Kelly Marie, I think the reason why it's been worded like that is because they're just desperately trying to get Parliament to actually debate the subject. And if they went too radical, the government would just say this goes completely against government policy and we're not going to debate it because, you know, it's been in the coalition agreement, blah, blah, blah. At least if you use the fig leaf of an impact assessment, which campaigning organisations like Transform Drugs Policy, which I'm, you know, I'm a big fan of and Release and so forth, I'm pretty sure they're all behind this, because they understand that, exactly like Paul said, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with, you know, small steps, and it does. You know, you've got to slowly chip away at the edifice. And what impacts assessment, I think the people who have organised this petition hope will demonstrate, is that the current situation isn't working. And at least then that narrative will help to take hold, and it might help to shift public opinion a bit more towards the kind of potential regulated legal environment that it's pretty clear we all hope we'll get. We need to move on because we haven't got much time. And I wanted to talk about voter recall as well, which, again, is something that I thought all the parties wanted to do. Well, certainly the Lib Dems and the Conservatives made clear that they wanted to do. It was in both of their manifestos and it formed part of the coalition agreement. And yet it's become clear that this week, the final legislative session, when it comes round, space has not been found for voter recall. So that means that MPs that have been found to have done wrongdoing can, unless they're sentenced to a jail sentence of 12 months or more, can actually remain in Parliament. And, you know, and even if they've done something that maybe hasn't warranted a jail sentence but has absolutely disgusted their electors, well, you know, if they find out a week after the election that that's what's happened, then they've got 4 years, 11 months and 3 weeks to wait before they can do anything about it. Kelly Marie, what do you think about this? Do you think that the government should have found space for this?
I really do think they should. I think, first of all, the Conservatives have kicked out the Liberal Democrat proposals to reform the House of Lords, which was diabolical, and now they've kicked out any opportunity for electoral reform at all. And we've seen some abysmal situations where MPs could have been recalled. Cases of fraud, cases of expenses fraud is the one that sticks in everybody's mind. But actually, if you look at some of the MPs that have been deselected by their local parties, Tim Yeo is the one that comes to mind. There are people that are extremely unhappy with their current MPs and nothing can be done. I do understand the flip side, of course, is that you don't want some public publicity campaign hounding MPs out of office just because somebody doesn't like them. And I do think that there are risks around that. However, it does seem ridiculous that you cannot remove someone from elected office.
Well, there is Kelly Marie, you said that, you know, it's the evil, nasty Tories who've done, you know, and don't get me wrong, like, I love a bit of Tory bashing. But the argument that I've seen is that actually the reason why they've rejected this is because what Clegg had proposed is that there would be a committee of MPs that would have to sit in judgment on the fellow MP to decide whether or not they then needed to trigger the process that could then lead to the electors. I think if the electors in the constituency signed a petition and more than 10% of them signed a petition, then that could trigger a recall election. So the problem was that actually it looked like another establishment stitch-up, and that's why they rejected it. So would you have been happy to have seen that go through?
I do see the proposal. I see the arguments against it. I don't think 10% is high enough, to be honest. You look at the election last week and there was less than 18% turnout, and that was for a by-election in a marginal seat. I wouldn't have been happy to see that go through, but ultimately I'm come around to the idea of mission creep in politics, and it would have been at least a step in the right direction, rather like making 5% of the House of Lords democratically electable. I mean, the government sources told The Independent that it went before the Quad, so we know who that was. That was Nick Clegg, Danny Alexander, David Cameron and George Osborne. And so at what point do those four people get to decide what does go in and what does go out of the coalition agreement? I would rather have seen it debated by all of our parliamentary party and more alternatives submitted.
Paul, quite a lot of Labour MPs were involved in the expenses scandal, weren't they? And a few of them actually ended up going to prison. Do you think that this should have been in place so that actually they could have been kicked out sooner than waiting until 2010?
I'm really conflicted over this, really, because I hate issues like this where, you know, some issues are quite easy where there's a very obvious answer as to whether you're going to do X or you're going to do Y. And it's quite easy to campaign and think on those things because you can say, oh, yes, we need more of this or we need less of that. And on this, I genuinely don't know what I think on this particularly, if I'm honest. I mean, I agree with the principle that if people are genuinely annoyed with their MP, that they've done something that's terrible, that's brought their office into disrepute, that they should have some mechanism to recall. But I do think the actual execution of this, that how the policy is manifested matters completely, because, you know, if it's only like Kelly Marie said, if it's just 10% of the electorate, that's pitifully, you're going to get a lot of campaigns to deselect MPs who are doing an otherwise good job, because that is not a lot of people that an opposition candidate who's annoyed at the election result can mobilise to get a petition together. And we're going to have constant battles within constituencies to get rid of controversial MPs. The other thing I would aspire to do, because I mean, I stood for Parliament in 2005 and I was the only candidate that opposed fox hunting. It was a rural Conservative constituency. And I know for a fact that I did very, very well because of that, because I was the only candidate on the ballot paper that advocated that. And then people of all parties who opposed fox hunting voted for me. And I really liked that. But I know for a fact that had I got elected, that would have annoyed so many people that I wouldn't have been able to have had the 5-year term in Parliament to have done something about it, because I would be constantly fighting battles in in my own seat. Having been elected for 5 years, you'd then have to put your energy, all your energies, into keeping the seat. And if you go, and if we do have representative parliamentary democracy, then yes, you know, we have to elect people for a term and then leave them to get on with it. And people are, you know, not everyone who disagrees with what an MP, their MP is going to do, is going to be, you know, altruistic and positively motivated and respect the fact they were democratically elected. So all right, we just have to be very careful about how we do this, because clearly, if someone is grossly irresponsible or guilty of a criminal offence, then they ought to be gotten rid of. But on the other hand, we need to make it as difficult as possible to get rid of them, without, short of making it impossible. And I know that makes me sound like a politician because it didn't answer the question, but I'm very, very conflicted on this, because we need MPs to be able to have enough security of tenure to do this. And I'll just make one final point, Mark, if I may, is that already I see governments not making strategic long-term decisions, because they need to be, by the very nature of the fact that governments get elected for only 5 years, there's an inherent short-termism to winning votes in the first place. Look at the floods, for example. You know, what we ought to be doing, like you said, like I said earlier, is taxing Vodafone properly, which would be very unpopular, and then putting that money into the floods and flood prevention. But no, you know, that is a very, very long-term financial policy that's got, people are going to, that would find it easy to attack in the short term, and therefore that I already think governments aren't long term enough, and this, right, to me smacks of short termism.
Okay, so that's fair enough. Sorry, Kelly Marie, I just wanted to, because Paul, you gave a very personal example there when you stood, and that, I think that is a good way of illustrating the potential problems with this. But I'll give you a personal example. I live in the Bracknell constituency, and in 2009, it was in May 2009, as the expenses scandal broke, it became clear that our MP at the time, Andrew Mackay, had claimed, I think it was £32,000 for his saying that he, on his second home, saying that one home that he had was his primary home and another home was his secondary home. Mm. And as it happened, he was married, I think still is, to Julie Kirkbride, who was another Tory MP. And what they'd done is they'd claimed the second home allowance on each other's houses. So they basically diddled the system by doing that. And therefore, he'd claimed over £30,000. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, maybe legally this wasn't the case, but as far as I'm concerned, it was fraudulent what he did.
It was immoral.
And, it was certainly immoral. And he called a public meeting in the constituency that I attended, and it was attended by hundreds of people. It was a big venue, and it was nearly full. And I would say 90% of the people, 95% of the people there were against him and were very, very angry as well.
And you actually
had Tory members. I remember one woman, she had a cut glass accent. She identified herself as a member of the Conservative Party. And even she was calling on him to stand down. And actually, at the time, what he was trying to do was remain the candidate for the coming election. And straight after that, David Cameron, I think, saw the footage that someone had filmed of the meeting. And even though Mackay tried to claim that, you know, that the event was broadly in his favour, it was very clear that it wasn't. And Cameron forced him to announce he wouldn't stand as a candidate in 2010. But that then left us with a lame duck MP for the next year that we couldn't do anything about. And he was never seen in the constituency again. I think he just went off in a big strop because he'd realised that his constituents weren't going to back him anymore. We didn't really have an MP for that final year. Now, that was terrible. And I think in that situation, we should have been able to recall him. I'm sure we could have hit whatever threshold you want to put in place, because most of the constituents were absolutely furious with him. And we could have had a by-election, got an MP that actually did something for us in 2009 and start in 2010. So, you know, I don't think this is a situation that can be allowed to carry on. All the party leaders promised that they would do something about this problem in 2009. And 5 years later, nothing's happened.
Mm-hmm. And even we've even seen the publications through IPSA being kicked into the long grass as well, where publication of results and MPs' expenses and the reviews into MPs' expenses were passed off. And actually, I think it's very easy to do that when it's not in the public consciousness. We're not getting a day-by-day breakdown by the Telegraph anymore. I mean, there are fundamental problems with the way that MPs are able to resign in themselves, being appointed to Chiltern Hundreds and the Manor of Northstead. We've got issues, and I think that an MP should be able to resign. That's bloody ridiculous that they can't, because all sorts of things can happen in that respect. But also that there should be some right by democratic process. But why not? Would we be happier perhaps with a vote if we had, if there, you know, 40% of the electorate say that they want another election in their constituency. Would we allow that? Who would pay for that? And would that be a better way of doing it, which might then mitigate some of the personal assaults that you get on single candidates?
Interesting. Well, it's pretty clear nothing's going to happen in this parliament. I can only hope that, you know, something happens maybe in the next parliament. But frankly, turkeys don't vote for Christmas, do they? So I wouldn't hold my breath. It's like the whole reform thing. It's very difficult to get any leverage on it. Just on, you were talking about the Chiltern Hundreds and the Manor of Norstead. Just a little bit of trivia, which I always found fascinating, and maybe no one else will, but I'm going to say it anyway. When Tony Blair resigned as Prime Minister in 2007, and Gordon Brown became Prime Minister immediately afterwards, and that evening, Tony Blair applied for the office of the Chiltern Hundreds in order to resign his seat as an MP. And by tradition, it's the Chancellor of the Exchequer that actually deals with that. And because in the situation we were in, Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, but he hadn't appointed a Chancellor, so Gordon Brown dealt with it. So he was technically both Prime Minister and Chancellor at the same time, which I think is the first time that's ever happened, at least.
I think he was basically the deputy prime minister throughout the entire run of Tony, wasn't he?
I'm sure he's delighted with that little bit of political history there.
Can I just make one final point though, Mark, about this? Yeah. Because I think that in a way that this is just a kind of smaller symptom of the electorate's massive disconnection from the political process. I mean, I don't understand why party strategists look at the appallingly low turnout and blame themselves for this, because we're ignoring the big issues and we seem to be making, you know, tiny policy changes around the margins here when we've got a society that's in serious trouble. And if I can just give you one example, you know, I stood for Parliament, as I say, in 2005. It was a very strong rural constituency, Tory incumbent, and I was never going to have any chance of winning. And I knocked on the door of someone and said, will you vote for me? It was election day. And he was watching Neighbours at the time. And he said, I've been a Labour member for 30 odd years. He said, why should I vote for you? Why should I actually get out of my chair and go to the polling booth? He said, because that's going to, my vote won't count. And I said, well, you've got to vote. You've got to show, you know, that voting matters and blah, blah, blah. And he said something really sensible. He said, yes, but, you know, you're not going to win. You're here to fight an unwinnable so that you can get a safe seat the next time. What matters here is that my vote genuinely does not count. And if it did, I would vote. And then just as I tried to persuade him to vote, and of course he didn't. As I walked down his garden path, a bus went past, and on it there was an advert from the Electoral Commission that said use your vote. And it just struck me as blatantly patronising in that moment that the Electoral Commission would patronise the voters to say, oh yeah, please vote, you know, you've got to do it, when actually the lack of turnout is indicative of the fact that most people like him had taken a genuinely realistic assessment of the likelihood of their vote actually making a difference in the world and decided that it wasn't worth bothering.
Yeah.
And until we have an electoral system that genuinely counts, that actually values the votes of real people, then unfortunately, rather than patronising people with adverts on the sides of buses saying, you know, please vote, people have decided that their vote doesn't count because that's what the evidence shows. And we therefore need to look at ourselves. The Westminster bubble needs to look at itself and stop patronising the electorate and have root and branch electoral reform. And that is, until we have proper proportional representation, we're just utterly in denial as a society.
Well, on a podcast with a current Lib Dem and a former Lib Dem, you're not going to get any dissent from that view, I'm sure. I would just say hallelujah to everything you just said. I listen to the Freakonomics podcast a lot and I've read the books. I'm a big fan of theirs. Yeah, and Stephen Levitt, who's the main economist involved with that, he made a comment on a recent episode that basically not voting is an entirely rational act. Because even if you had a proportional system, you know, your vote isn't really, one individual vote isn't going to make any difference. It's the aggregated all of the votes. But absolutely, of course, in a proportional system, you know, you're far more likely to make a difference than you are under the current system. You're absolutely right. Okay. Well, I think that's been a good episode, but we need to wrap things up now. So I'd just like to thank my guests, Kelly Marie Blundell. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck in your seat.
Thank you very much.
And thanks very much, Paul Blanchard, for being with us tonight. And also, we did allude to it during the podcast, but you're the Vice President of the Media Society and you do a podcast as well, don't you? Would you like to tell us about that?
I do indeed. Yes, it's you've been on it, Mark. So that's, I have. You know, it's www.themediasociety.com/podcast. And we get together every fortnight, a couple of interesting people, and we talk media matters. And it's, even if I do say so myself, it's quite interesting. And if any of your listeners want to tune into to that, I'd be very grateful.
Yeah, it was a good experience being on it, and I've listened to all of them so far, and they've all been very, very good quality. So
Thank
yeah,
you.
I think it's been a nice little venture
Well,
for you.
Mark,
And
you're a former Lib Dem, and Kelly Marie is obviously still a Lib Dem. But can I just take you into a confidence and say I actually voted Lib Dem at the last election.
Oh.
I know. I live in Hampstead, and it was a genuine three-way battle. And I love Glenda
Yeah.
Jackson. I think she's a great MP.
Well,
But
you voted for Ed Fordham.
I couldn't stand. Yes, I did. Yeah, I couldn't stand the Conservative candidate in the election. And because I genuinely thought Glenda Jackson couldn't win, and that was a genuinely held belief. I mean, I would have voted for Glenda if she could have won. And I said to quite a few of my friends, if only, only an idiot would think Glenda Jackson would win, and therefore I voted Lib Dems to keep the Tory out. And of course, she then surprised everyone and
Yeah,
won.
I'm
So
sure.
all hats off to her. And the last thing I'd like to say is I'm considering, even though I'm a very strident Labour Party member, I'm considering voting Lib Dem again at the next election because of the Lib Dem candidate in Hampstead here is very, very kind of strident on secular issues and freedom of speech. And I actually like the guy personally, and I think he deserves to win. So I will always vote Labour, apart from in the last election and in the next election.
Well, I'm sure Ed Fordham is delighted that his 474 votes campaign obviously persuaded you, and
He did.
obviously didn't quite persuade enough people, unfortunately,
What
but
a shame.
good stuff. Okay, and just before we finish, I'd also like to just give some more details about what I mentioned at the start, which is that we're coming up to our 100th episode in a couple
Wow.
of weeks' time. And in order to celebrate that, we're having all three of our current hosts on, so myself, Emma Burnell, and also Nick Dennis. But also, we're going to have back the chap who used to co-host the House of Commons podcast a few years ago when we first started. He was the co-host for the first 38 episodes, Stuart Sharp. He's not been back since we restarted, but he's joining us for the episode. And also, we're going to have the person who was our first ever guest on our first ever episode, and that was then prominent Tory blogger and now LBC presenter Ian Dale. So we're looking forward to that very much in a couple of weeks' time. Next week, we've got Nick Dennis, who's going to be hosting. And then, like I say, I'll be back in a couple of weeks' time. So I'd just like to thank Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music and Audioboo for hosting the podcast on the internet.